The best insight, instant feedback, accountability. The all-new Talk Radio Freedom 106.5.
Good afternoon to you, Dr. Dean. How are you?
Good afternoon, Tusker, and good afternoon to all our listeners out there. It is the last lunchtime, Doctor, for the week. I know we had a short week, but of course we had very interesting topics to talk about as well. So yesterday we spoke about obstructive sleep apnea, and that word cortisol came up quite a bit. And as we know, cortisol is the stress hormone in our body. So today we're going to talk about stress and cortisol and how that exactly affects our body and what are the long-term complications of having an increased level of cortisol in the body. So just for, you know, the general public to get a proper understanding of this particular hormone and what its impact is on the body. But of course, while we are speaking about this specific topic, anybody can feel free to call in, send a WhatsApp on any of their medical conditions. We'll have a conversation surrounding that.
All right, and the questions now coming in. What exactly is cortisol, and why is it often referred to as the stress hormone?
So cortisol is a steroid hormone, and it is actually produced by these little glands that sit right above the kidneys. They're called the adrenal glands. And what cortisol does is that it helps your body to maintain your blood pressure, to regulate the metabolism, mobilize energy throughout the body, and help to modulate an immune response when needed. It actually follows a natural daily rhythm. So we'd find that cortisol is highest in the morning to help you wake up and lowest at night so that you can fall asleep properly. Now, during threats or different challenges that we may face in our everyday life, cortisol works alongside adrenaline, which we know as that fight or flight hormone, to prepare you to respond. And it makes glucose more available for the brain to use and for the muscles to use. And it also temporarily shifts the resources away from the non-urgent functions like the digestion or the reproductive functions of the body. So calling cortisol the stress hormone is a little bit misleading, because cortisol is essential for normal health. Too little is as dangerous as having too much cortisol. And the problem is not cortisol itself. It is the chronic, the unrelenting activation of this cortisol in the body over an extended period of time. People tend to think that all cortisol is bad, but in reality, having very short bursts of cortisol, it's very adaptive for our body, and it's also very protective. People also think that you can or you should shut off cortisol, and you don't want that. You know, the goal is to have a healthy rhythm of that cortisol, have it robust in the morning and gently tapering across the day. So it's not to have zero cortisol, but just to have a proper, natural, healthy rhythm of that cortisol.
How does the body normally produce and regulate cortisol under healthy conditions?
So cortisol is controlled by what we call the HPA axis. So the hypothalamus, the pituitary, and the adrenal glands. The hypothalamus releases a hormone called cortisol-releasing hormone, and the hypothalamus is located in the brain as well as the pituitary. And that cortisol-releasing hormone signals the pituitary, which is also located in the brain, to release ACTH, which then tells the adrenal glands that is located in the body to produce cortisol. And as cortisol rises, it feeds back to the brain to dial down these other hormones, that cortisol-releasing hormone and that ACTH, to maintain balance within the body. Now, this system essentially generates what we call the circadian rhythm. And that means having that morning peak of cortisol, which is the cortisol awakening response. And that is about 30 to 45 minutes after waking and a low point of that cortisol near midnight. Now, people think that stress alone is what dominates that cortisol production. But in truth, we have light exposure, the timing of your sleep, the timing of your meals even, your physical activity, and even your social connection. All of these things influence the clock that regulates your cortisol. And people also tend to think that once the cortisol is dysregulated, your system cannot recover. Now, severe illnesses can injure this axis that we've been talking about, that HPA axis, but most people can actually restore to a healthier rhythm with having consistent sleep, having proper daylight exposure, having regular meals and movement, and of course, their stress recovery habits as well.
All right, folks, basis in 12 minutes after 12 o'clock. You're listening to the Lunchtime Doctor. As always, we will take an opportunity to take some of your calls, take a break to take some of your calls in just a short while at 625-2257, 627-3223. Send those WhatsApp messages at 306-1065. We'll break for that shortly. But can you explain the difference between short-term stress and chronic stress and how each affects cortisol levels?
So short-term or acute stress, as we call it, like say you have a deadline for something or a near miss in traffic or even exercise. Exercise is considered acute stress on the body. It triggers a brief and sharp increase in cortisol that helps you to focus, to react quickly, and to recover as well. Now, once that stressor passes, for example, you submit the work that you were supposed to submit and you start to feel safe within your body, the HPA axis actually turns down and cortisol now returns to its baseline. And these pulses are very much normal and they're often very beneficial to the body. And it even improves your memory consolidation and your performance for a time. Now, the problem happens when stress becomes chronic. Chronic stress like ongoing financial strain or caregiving without having proper support or untreated anxiety or poor sleep. And here's the thing, your body cannot distinguish between different types of stress. So whether it's physical, emotional, mental, spiritual, your body perceives all stress the same way. And if you constantly have any sort of chronic stress, that keeps this HPA axis that we were talking about, it keeps it simmering. So cortisol may stay elevated for long periods, or it may even become erratic. And over time, that pattern is what contributes to people suffering from fatigue or abdominal weight gain, insulin resistance, having their blood pressure elevated, having a lot of mood changes, and having a lot of sleep problems as well. People tend to think that persons that are under chronic stress, they always have high cortisol, but some actually just develop a blunted rhythm with low daytime levels and poor responsiveness, and that is also unhealthy for the body.
All right, and what are the main effects of high cortisol levels on the body's major systems? Like brain, heart, metabolism, and immune system.
So if we're looking at the brain, if you have persistently high cortisol, that impairs your hippocampus, which is the memory and learning part of your brain. And it also heightens what we call the amygdala reactivity. And that is where fear and certain emotions come from, and it also reduces the planning and the impulse regulation centers in the brain as well. So persons are going to notice that they're suffering from brain fog and forgetfulness and irritability, and they have this wired but tired feeling. Now, in the cardiovascular system, cortisol actually increases your sensitivity to adrenaline, so it can raise your blood pressure and your heart rate over time. And that is what is going to continuously contribute to hypertension and a wear and tear of your blood vessels. Now, when we look at metabolism, cortisol promotes gluconeogenesis, and that is just a big fancy term for glucose production in the body. And it also increases your appetite, especially for the very calorie-dense foods and the sugary, the refined sugars. So if you realize that you're under stress for something, you'd realize that you're craving, say, the chocolates, the sugars, the greasy, the fatty foods, all of these things are very calorie dense. And it also encourages fat storage centrally. So what that means is that it will contribute to visceral adiposity or weight gain within the abdominal area mostly. And that pattern raises the risk for insulin resistance and, of course, type 2 diabetes. Now, when we look at the immune system as well, short-term cortisol actually tends to dampen any sort of excessive inflammation. So it's helpful in the short-term response. But if you have chronic elevation of that cortisol, it actually skews your immunity. So it raises a person's susceptibility to infections, and it also worsens inflammatory conditions for some people as well. People tend to think that stress alone causes ulcers, but like we mentioned when we were talking about ulcers, most ulcers are from the H. pylori bacteria or even NSAID use. And stress can aggravate those symptoms, but it isn't usually the sole cause of ulcers.
Hi, people. Once again, you listen to The Lunchtime Doctor, Freedom 106.5 FM, Sangit 106.1 and Sky 99.5. How does chronic stress and elevated cortisol affects weight gain, especially around the belly area?
So cortisol actually shifts your fat storage, and it shifts any sort of fat storage that you have in the body towards the abdomen, where it becomes metabolically active and it's now close to the liver. Now, this visceral fat, as we call it, it actually secretes inflammatory molecules, and these inflammatory molecules, it promotes insulin resistance in the body, and it creates this loop in which higher insulin and cortisol drives more central fat storage. So the more fat storage that you get because of cortisol in the abdomen creates this feedback loop where the more that you have, the more fat storage you're going to get. Cortisol also increases a person's appetite and cravings for sugar and fat, and it may also reduce the signals that tell your brain that you're full. So people tend to eat more, especially when sleep is in short durations. And one of the myths that people tend to have is that cortisol makes you gain weight no matter what you do. Stress biology makes weight management harder, but it doesn't make it impossible. So certain things like prioritizing 7 to 9 hours of sleep, consistently having your meals on time with adequate protein and fiber, resistance training, and even certain parasympathetic practices like slow breathing, having exposure to nature, having proper social connection. All of these things actually counteract cortisol's effects. And another thing that people tend to think is that if you cut carbs, you're going to fix cortisol. Very low-carb diets can raise your cortisol in some people. So I would say that it is much better to have balanced complex carbs, especially after working out and at dinner, to get that sleep support in as well.
Hey folks, this is where we take time out to answer any of your medical questions, even though we're dealing with this cortisol topic. Call us up right now, 625-2257. 627-3223. Maybe there's a question you've been wanting to ask the doctor for the longest while. Something on your mind, something happened to you last week, or maybe for a friend, a relative, a loved one. Hold us up, let's get those questions. Good day, doctor. How do you define if someone is overweight?
So when we look at overweight and obesity, we actually look at the body mass index scale. So the definition of being overweight using BMI is having a BMI of 25 to 29.9. So your BMI is actually based on your height versus your weight. And this is for adults. For children, we actually plot this on a graph. But in terms of adults, I would say the BMI between 25 to 29.9 is usually used to determine if somebody is overweight. But again, this does not take into consideration somebody's muscle mass. So somebody can have a BMI of 27, but it could be just because they have a high amount of muscle mass on their body as well. So it's really about discerning as well. So BMI is not the full story. It does not take into account your body composition, your fat distribution, your muscle mass. So we often combine that BMI with waist circumference, body fat percentage, other metabolic markers as well.
Mm-hmm. Question here coming from Sky. Hi, I went to the health center for my back. They sent me to Mount Hope for an appointment. The appointment is in 2028. Why so long?
Well, I'm not too sure why it's so long, but I'm guessing that it is probably because they have a backlog of certain things, and they are what happens with appointments is that they prioritize based on need at that point in time. So somebody who has more emergent needs will get a quicker appointment.
Well, I mean, if this person has a back pain now, by the time they're ready for the appointment, I mean, it might, you know, in 2028.
Yes, so it's a backlog. I'm guessing they probably send that person for an MRI.
Well, people, try not to get sick, please. What causes brain fog?
So like we just discussed, having high elevated levels of cortisol for an elevated period of time, that is what can lead to brain fog in some people. And brain fog by itself, it's not really a disease, but it's really just a symptom that describes, you know, mental cloudiness, poor focus, forgetfulness. And that stress and cortisol imbalance will definitely impair your memory and focus. Having poor sleep as well, that can reduce your mental sharpness by up to about 40%. Dietary factors, skipping your meals, eating too much sugar. Even for women going through hormonal changes like perimenopause, menopause, all of these things do contribute to brain fog. And there are certain medical conditions like anxiety and depression, even diabetes can contribute as well.
Good day, doctor. How can you stop someone from biting their fingernails? And, you know, is there really a problem doing so?
So when we're looking at biting, people do bite their fingernails, and that is I would say that's a common habit, and it will start in childhood and it will persist into adulthood as well. A lot of people do it without realizing it, especially when they're stressed out, when they're anxious, even when they're bored or when they're concentrating as well. I will admit, when I was in med school and I had high levels of stress, I was a nail biter. But for some people, it's actually a soothing mechanism. So it's like the body self-regulating its emotions, and they will just do it unconsciously. Now, I would say for persons to stop biting their nails, they need to identify what the triggers are, if it's stress or if it's anxiety. And once you know those triggers, you can plan to have healthier coping mechanisms. I would say to keep your nails short and well-groomed as well. And there are even nail solutions that can be applied to the nails that are kind of anti-bite nail coatings as well, that will create a very unpleasant taste and will help you break the habit unconsciously.
All right, we do have a caller holding on the line. Thanks for holding. Hello?
Good afternoon. Mm-hmm. Calling from Pinal. The way I handle these lifestyle things, I tell myself up front, due to the experience of life, that you're going to feel here and there. Just get back on track. A lot of people take their lifestyle changes with a kind of religious zeal, and when they start to struggle with it, they abandon them. My experience is you just keep struggling. I mean, you must win. You have to win. Otherwise, what's the cost of losing? You know, it's like what they say, if you think education is expensive, try ignorance. If you think being well and doing all the right things, like your diet, the things that you can do, and following your doctor is one of them, exercise, diet, rest, stay on the good side, you know, and you will fall from time to time, and you just get to walk back over on the good side and keep going. But what I have found is too many people feel, I can't do that. I can't keep up with that. And I fall off 3 times already. What happened, happened. Doc, I want to comment on that. Thank you.
So I agree to an extent. And there are some people who are able to decipher that this is just a small setback in their life. But there are also some people that live in that chronic state. And it may require more than willpower for some people to get out of the rut that they may be in. Sometimes it does require having an accountability partner. Sometimes it does require having a therapist to get you back on track. But at the end of the day, once people get into that pattern of getting their life back on track, starting to do the healthy habits on a daily basis, that is where real change starts to set in.
All right, let's get another question from our friends at Sky. Loving it. Of course, you could send your messages to Sky or Sangit 106.1 and they will send it to us right here in studio. Good day. How do you care for someone with a stroke?
So, in terms of a stroke, this is going to be dependent on how severe or debilitating that stroke was. And after the immediate phase, for example, once they are discharged from the hospital, you need to follow their treatment plan that they have been given by their doctor carefully. So that will include the medications that they were given and any sort of physical restrictions that they were given as well. And medication management is definitely crucial. So if you are the caretaker, you are going to be responsible for managing the medications and when they have to take it. You also want to monitor any sort of warning signs or complications. And you are going to need a team, again, depending on how debilitating the stroke was, for physical care and for physical rehabilitation. I would say let them start that physical therapy, the occupational therapy and the speech therapy, whichever they need, or if they need all three. These are things that are essential to regain any sort of lost function. And the earlier that they are able to start, the better the recovery is going to be. You need to assist with them mobilizing safely and prevent any sort of complications by encouraging gentle movement, repositioning them every 2 hours if they're bedridden, having stretching exercises to prevent any stiffness and soreness. And nutrition also does matter. So choosing a diet that is low in sodium, fats, and low in the processed foods will help to protect the heart and the brain. And if swallowing is difficult as well for them, then a speech therapist may be helpful in providing safe techniques and textures as well.
All right, 12:30 on time. Let's get back to our topic, you know, of course, and we'll get back to some of your questions. Keep sending them to 3061065 and we'll take some calls shortly. Can prolonged stress and high cortisol lead to our health conditions, to other health conditions like diabetes, hypertension, or hormonal imbalances?
So yes, chronically elevated or even dysregulated cortisol will contribute to insulin resistance, a higher fasting glucose reading, and eventually, if it is left untreated, type 2 diabetes in susceptible individuals. It is also something that stiffens the blood vessels and it increases a person's blood pressure, now putting them at risk for hypertension as well. And over time, this cardiometabolic stress is going to add up in the body, especially if you're pairing it with unhealthy habits like poor sleep, a sedentary lifestyle, smoking, or ultra-processed foods as well. Cortisol is something that interacts with other hormones, so it can actually suppress thyroid conversion in the body, it will aggravate menstrual irregularities. It reduces testosterone in men, and it also alters your appetite hormones as well. And people tend to think that one supplement or, say, a cortisol blocker can solve that problem, but there's no pill that can actually replace the impact of sleep regularity and physical activity and even stress recovery skills and nutrition as well. In the medically significant cases, for example, if we're looking at conditions where cortisol is in a medical condition like Cushing's syndrome, then these persons are going to need targeted medical therapy, not over-the-counter products. So they are going to need actual prescribed products to suppress that cortisol production.
Right. And how does cortisol affect the brain memory and emotional regulation?
So moderate cortisol surges, I would say it can sharpen a person's attention, and it does help to encode memories, especially the emotional ones as well. But having persistently elevated levels actually disrupts your hippocampal functions, and it makes it harder to form new memories and to retrieve the old ones as well. Now, the prefrontal cortex of the brain, this is the portion of the brain that is actually responsible for planning and impulse control, that also takes a hit under chronic stress. And of course, the fear signaling portion of the brain, that also becomes more dominant. So people tend to feel a lot more jumpier, they're a lot more reactive, and they're less able to sort of hit the brakes in their body. People tend to think that stress is something that permanently damages the brain. Now, extreme trauma can cause lasting changes. The brain is plastic. Now, reducing stress load and improving your sleep and exercising, especially if we look at aerobic and resistance training, even practicing mindfulness on a daily basis, and for some people who require cognitive behavioral therapy, and just having meaningful social connections, that can literally strengthen these circuits in your brain, and it quiets that fear center in your brain as well. So the brain is trainable, and it's better that we think of the brain as trainable than just being broken after having elevated levels of cortisol in it.
All right, 12:34 on time. Of course, you're locked onto Freedom 106.5 FM, Sangit 106.1 and Sky 99.5. You're listening to The Lunchtime Doctor. Topic today is cortisol. And is there a connection between chronic stress, anxiety, depression, and high cortisol levels?
So I would say it's a two-way relationship. Chronic stress can definitely raise or dysregulate cortisol, and it does contribute to anxiety and depressive symptoms. So people will get poor sleep, low energy. They may lose pleasure in doing things that they once enjoyed. They may have increased levels of frustration and irritability. And even in some depressive subtypes, for example, melancholic depression, cortisol can be higher. And in other subtypes of depression, the rhythm becomes very blunted. Anxiety can keep the HPA axis on this sort of standby mode, so it's ready to fire, and it will start sustaining symptoms in the body, even if the person is in some sort of safe context or safe environment. People tend to think that measuring a single cortisol value diagnoses anxiety or depression. Now, mental health conditions are actually clinical diagnoses, and cortisol is just one piece of that puzzle. People also tend to think that you have to eliminate stress to be able to recover. You don't need a stress-free life. You just need a very regulated system so that you are able to handle whatever stress that life throws at you. So certain skills like pace, breathing, exposure to natural light, exercise, therapy, community support, all of these things help to reduce your symptoms even when you have life stresses that are ongoing.
All right, and what about how does cortisol affect the brain, memory, and emotional regulation?
So when we look at the brain and our memory and emotional regulation, remember I just spoke about those moderate cortisol surges can actually sharpen your attention. It will help you to sort of encode your memories, especially those emotional ones. But the persistent levels really do affect your ability to form the new memories. It affects your ability to plan. It affects your impulse control. And it also ensures that your amygdala fear signals are heightened in certain situations as well.
And people, we'll be getting to some of your questions just a short while. Hold on. Do cortisol levels affect men and women differently, especially in terms of hormonal balance and overall health?
So men and women share the same biology when it comes to that HPA axis, but sex hormones modulate the response of that HPA axis. So estrogen and progesterone in women influences the binding of cortisol and the sensitivity of our tissues to cortisol. So women are going to experience more reactivity in this HPA axis at certain cycle phases and even postpartum as well. And that's when hormones start to shift very quickly. Chronic stress in women, more commonly, it presents as sleep disturbances, it presents as fatigue, headaches, even IBS type symptoms, and of course, menstrual irregularities. Now, in men, chronic stress is associated with lower testosterone, having a reduced libido, that central weight gain that we talked about, and a higher cardiometabolic risk. People think that men are less affected by stress because they talk about it less, but the physiology says otherwise. Women's symptoms are not just hormonal either. In reality, stress and sex hormones interact both ways, and addressing your sleep, your nutrition, your workload, and even your recovery on a daily basis helps all genders.
All right, folks, let's take an opportunity right now to get any of your questions, your medical questions. Lunchtime Doctor, Dr. Brittany Dean is here. Once again, those numbers, 625-2257, 627-3223, WhatsApp 3061065. You can WhatsApp Sangeet and Sky, and they will send it to us right here in studio. Good day, Doctor. I am a 48-year-old male. I have been getting an intermittent stomach pain like every 45 minutes since March 2025. It only lasts about 20 seconds. I did an ultrasound and everything showed normal. What other tests can be done?
So in terms of the intermittent stomach pain, we definitely have to look at what could possibly be the cause of that intermittent stomach pain. And I would say to look at the triggers of why you're getting the stomach pain. Is it after eating a certain meal? Is it after eating fatty foods? If so, then we can assume it could possibly be biliary colic without having actual stones. So it may have some sort of sludge within the gallbladder itself that is not actually seen on the standard ultrasound. It could be even irritable bowel syndrome. But again, this is a diagnosis of exclusion, meaning that we have to rule out everything first before actually diagnosing you with irritable bowel syndrome. And if the pain is relieved by passing stool or it's worsened by meals, this could possibly be a reason. Now, peptic ulcer disease is also something we have to consider, and ultrasounds will, of course, miss that. Even small bowel changes, all of these things can be missed on an ultrasound, or just spasms in the colon, especially if it's alternating between like constipation or diarrhea. So we definitely need to, you need to get a proper evaluation. You need to tell your doctor what type of pain it is, where's the actual location of that pain, what triggers it, what relieves it, is there any associated symptoms, what is your diet and lifestyle like. We have to look at all, we have to look at the bigger picture before actually diagnosing you with something and sending you to do specific tests.
Hi, good day, doctor. What can cause a pinched nerve?
So pinched nerves can be caused by a number of different things. And one of the main ones that we do see would be a herniated disc. So, for example, if it's in the neck or the lower back, a slip disc can actually press on the nerve root that is nearby. Bone spurs or arthritis and extra bone growth from osteoarthritis can narrow the pathways of nerves. Even muscle tightness or even spasms can cause that, repetitive movements, carpal tunnel syndrome if it's in the hand, and obesity can also increase the pressure on the nerves as well. So these are the main things that we would usually see leading to pinched nerves more commonly.
Good day, doc. Can an ingrowing toenail be bad for your health?
So when we're looking at ingrown toenails, yes, it can be if it is getting infected. Now, if you're wearing too much tight footwear, if you've had some sort of trauma to the foot, even just genetics, some people just have naturally more curved toenails. You just need to ensure that there's no swelling or warmth or clear fluid or yellow fluid that is flowing out of it like pus, or it's not giving off a foul odor, there's no increased swelling, because these things indicate that there are signs of infections. If there's nothing like this, you do want to do some home care, like soaking your feet in warm water, even gently lifting the nail itself, and helping to clean the area, and wear your proper footwear. Don't wear anything that is too tight on the toes.
All right, we have a short voice message here. Let's
hey, doctor, what causes obesity?
Oh, what causes obesity?
So, obesity is a very complex condition. Now, obesity is having an excess amount of body fat that is increasing your risk of serious health problems like diabetes, heart disease, stroke, certain cancers as well. And the causes, this is something we call multifactorial. So it's really just one cause that is causing it. It's a complex interaction between your genetics, between hormones, environment, your lifestyle habits, and even your mental health as well. In terms of lifestyle and behavioral factors, we definitely see an excessive caloric intake, like regular consumption, high calorie, the ultra processed foods, the sugary drinks, and combining that with a lack of physical activity, poor sleep, stress, and emotional eating, and having a family history as well. If one parent is obese, a child's risk actually increases by 40%. And if both are obese, the child's risk increases by about 70%. And a lot of this does not just have to do with genetics. It has to do with the environment that the child grows up in. So if you're constantly in the same environment with somebody that is constantly not exercising or working out, and also eating the processed foods, chances are more than likely you are going to be developing the same habits.
All right, of course, 625-2257, 625-2257, 6273-223. But any more questions? Let's get one on the WhatsApp here. Does taking probiotic tablets help with digestion?
So probiotic tablets are essentially the bacteria that is needed for proper gut health and immunity. So they're basically these microorganisms, like the beneficial bacteria and yeast, that support that healthy balance of gut bacteria. And they are often the good bacteria because they do help to maintain your digestive health and help your immune system strengthen and regulate any sort of inflammation in the body as well. So I would say that it does have a good role in helping your digestion on a daily basis if you're taking it.
I see a question on the phone line. Say hello, good day. Yes, sir. All right, if you're on the speakerphone, so you need to come off the speakerphone. We won't hear you clearly.
All right. Yes. Can I talk to the doctor now?
So go ahead.
Yes, doc. I have a problem. My stomach hurts plenty sometimes. I feel very nauseated. And after I leave my stomach, it goes to my head. I feel kind of woozy, you know, kind of dizzy.
So again, this could be multifactorial, and there are possible causes because your symptoms are starting in the stomach and then you get nausea and then it finally ends up getting to become a headache. We need to think about conditions that affect that gut-brain connection or that gut-brain access, because the digestive system and the nervous system are closely linked. So things like gastritis or acid reflux. So if you're eating things that irritate the stomach lining, that causes that same abdominal discomfort and nausea. And sometimes you get that referred pain to the head as well. If you've had some sort of food intolerance, so having bad foods or spoiled meals recently, that can trigger the stomach upset and nausea. And people do get the dehydration, and that leads to headaches. Gallbladder issues are another aspect that you have to look at. The gallstones, the bile reflux, that causes the abdominal pain after the fatty meals and nausea. And some people also develop headaches as well. And there's also something called an abdominal migraine. That is more common in children, but we do see it in adults as well. So persons will get episodic stomach pain and nausea and a headache that comes with that.
All right, let's get back to our topic here. So how does chronic stress influence women's reproductive health, menstrual cycles, and even menopause?
So one thing about the brain is that it prioritizes survival over reproduction under chronic stress. And elevated cortisol levels can actually suppress the signals that go to our sex hormones. And that leads to irregular or missed periods. It leads to worsened premenstrual syndrome and even ovulatory issues as well. It can intensify a person's pain perception. So it exacerbates certain conditions that women may have, like endometriosis and PCOS symptoms. Now, in pregnancy, uncontrolled severe stress is actually linked with sleep disturbances and higher risk of mood symptoms. So good prenatal care is definitely needed here. And it also supports, it also mitigates any sort of risk to the pregnancy as well. Around perimenopause and menopause, the fluctuating or the declining estrogen can make sleep lighter and it makes the thermoregulation less stable. Now, if stress is high, women often report night waking, hot flashes, brain fog, mood swings, being a lot more disruptive at these times. Now, people tend to think that all of this is just menopause and there's nothing you can do about it, but sleep optimization, strength training, having protein forward diets, stress recovery practices, and when appropriate, discussions of those menopausal hormonal therapy with your doctor can actually improve a woman's quality of life.
And what are the common signs and symptoms that a person may have chronically high cortisol levels?
So I would say red flags would be if the person has poor sleep, especially if they're waking up between 2 to 4 a.m., they have fatigue, but they have a very wired feeling. For example, do you know that feeling you get when you drink too much caffeine, but you are very tired as well? That is a wired but tired feeling. If they have new or stubborn belly weight, if they have a lot of sugar or salt cravings, if their blood pressure is creeping up, if they have frequent headaches, acne or skin thinning, if they're bruising very easily, and if they have a low libido. Now, mood-wise, I find that a lot of people tend to notice irritability, anxiety, that brain fog that we talked about, and they start to feel overwhelmed by ordinary tasks as well. Now, in the more severe cases, like the true Cushing syndrome, then people are going to notice that they're getting purple stretch marks, they're getting weakness in their legs or the proximal muscles, and they may get recurrent infections as well. You know, not every tired or stressed person has this adrenal fatigue, as we call it. That term isn't actually a recognized medical diagnosis. The real conditions at the ends of the spectrum are adrenal insufficiency, too little cortisol, and that's often an immune condition, an autoimmune condition, and Cushing syndrome, where you have too much cortisol from, say, steroid medications or tumors. And most people with stress-related symptoms have just an HPA dysregulation without any sort of failure of their adrenal glands. And that is very much treatable with lifestyle, with therapy, and when appropriate, the proper medical care as well.
Of course, what lifestyle factors contributes most to chronic stress and elevated cortisol?
So I would say the big four are sleep deprivation or sleep irregularity, ultra-processed diets and having very erratic meal timing, physical inactivity or even overtraining without recovery as well, and psychosocial stress without proper outlets. So people who are lonely, people who have strain from caregiving, who have job insecurity, all of these things contribute to elevated levels of cortisol. Now, you also need to add in light at night, caffeine or alcohol use close to bedtime, endless notifications on your phone, and lack of daylight exposure. All of these things confuse your circadian rhythm, and they keep that HPA axis on guard. People tend to think that only dramatic trauma dysregularities are responsible for cortisol or the dysregulation of cortisol, but daily micro stressors accumulate when you don't have proper recovery for the body, and you cannot out-supplement the poor habits. Magnesium supplements or the adaptogens, they may help some individuals, but they are just supportive at best. Restoring proper regularity in the body, like consistent sleep-wake cycles, having morning sunlight, having movement, having nourishing meals and the connection and the boundaries with screen time at night, all of these things actually do more for cortisol rhythm than any sort of supplement.
And how can someone find out if their cortisol levels are too high or too low? Are there tests available?
So there are tests that are available, but like I said, there's no one reading of cortisol that can diagnose everything. When we're looking at cortisol to be tested for certain medical conditions, we would often look at a 24-hour cortisol or urine test, and that is something that we would use to confirm Cushing syndrome or rule out any sort of severe cortisol excess. There's also salivary cortisol tests as well that measure your cortisol patterns throughout the day, and of course there's the blood or serum cortisol test.
4 minutes away from 1 o'clock. You're listening to the Lunchtime Doctor today, Wednesday already. Final Lunchtime Doctor for the week. And what are some effective ways to lower cortisol levels naturally through diet, exercise, sleep, and relaxation techniques?
So I would say sleep is actually the master leveler. So you want to aim for 7 to 9 hours of sleep. You want to also have a consistent sleep-wake time. And what I mean by that is that you're consistently going to bed at 10 o'clock and consistently waking up at 6 o'clock. So having consistent sleep-wake times, morning sunlight as well within an hour of waking. So just stepping outside and getting some sunlight on your body, that also helps to regulate your circadian rhythm. And dim light, especially screens, for 2 hours before bed. Exercising on most days as well, combining your resistance training 2 to 3 days a week with moderate aerobic activities like brisk walking, cycling, and paradoxically, smarter training actually reduces your cortisol over time. So you want to avoid stacking the intense exercises like the high-intensity interval training late at night, and you need to respect your recovery days. You cannot be going every single day and not taking that one day to recover or having some sort of active recovery protocol. You also want to nourish a steady metabolism. So prioritize your protein, you know, having about a palm-sized portion of protein per meal, having your high-fiber plants, your healthy fats, your slow carbs, and you don't want to fear having a balanced earlier dinner and a light protein snack if you wake hungry at night as well. You also want to practice down regulation, like having 5 to 10 minutes of slow nasal breathing, or just even journaling. For some people, journaling does help them. And 10 minutes in nature or with supportive people really has shown to lower measurable stress markers as well.
And finally, if someone is experiencing chronic stress, when should they consider seeking medical help or professional support?
So if the stress starts to impair your daily function, like persistent insomnia, panic attacks, depressive symptoms, significant weight change, blood pressure or blood sugar elevations, or if you've noticed that you're getting recurrent infections, these are some of, you know, the factors that you look at for seeking help. And then the red flags are if the person is having suicidal thoughts, severe chest pain, shortness of breath. These things actually require urgent evaluation. If you're using alcohol or stimulants or sedatives to cope, it is time to start bringing that to your clinician. There are safer, more effective strategies. And you also want to seek care if you notice any sort of Cushing-like features. So if you notice that you're bruising very easily, you're noticing purple streaks on your abdomen, you're noticing a new significant amount of central obesity and muscle weakness as well, or even symptoms of adrenal insufficiency. So you are consistently and profoundly fatigued. You're noticing weight loss, low blood pressure, salt, your skin is getting darker. These are things that you need to take to your physician. People think that seeing a doctor won't help because it's just stress, but good care also includes sleep and stress recovery coaching, therapy options, evaluating for the medical issues, and when appropriate, having targeted therapies as well. You do not have to tackle everything alone.
All right, Doc, well, that'll be it for today, and that'll be it for this week. Thank you very much.
Okay, see you next week.
The best insight, instant feedback, accountability. The all-new Talk Radio Freedom 106.5.